against black people. In the months after the shooting, the federal investigation discovered some important truths. The Ferguson police have been engaged in a pattern of discriminatory behavior directed at African Americans. And the town governance, from ticketing practices to the bail system, operated to oppress black people. As in so many American towns and cities, the police needed to change before African Americans would trust them. It was understandable that Michael Brown's death was a tragic spark that ignited a powder keg built by oppressive policing in that community. But in the end, the Department of Justice found there wasn't sufficient evidence to charge that police officer with federal civil rights crimes for shooting Michael Brown. FBI agents knocked on hundreds of doors throughout Ferguson and discovered not only that there was not sufficient evidence, but also that early media accounts of the shooting were factually wrong and misleading. Contrary to what most of the public had heard or thought they had seen, there was reliable evidence that Michael Brown was not surrendering when he was shot, and there was DNA evidence that he had assaulted the officer and tried to take his gun. In one sense, those conclusions by federal investigators, reached months after Michael Brown's death, didn't matter. Most of the world had already heard false reports and believed Brown was gunned down while surrendering with his hands up. In the time it took for the truth to get its boots on, false information had circled the earth many times. The Department of Justice's conclusions were important, but late. By spring 2015, when the department completed its work and publicly released a detailed account of the investigation and its conclusions, several highly publicized videotaped encounters between police and African Americans had dramatically increased the focus on police use of force. Millions watched videos of violent police encounters, including NYPD officers killing Eric Garner with a chokehold, and Cleveland police officers shooting 12-year-old Tamir Rice in a city park. Millions more watched as Walter Scott was murdered by a South Carolina police officer, who, after shooting Scott in the back, was then captured on video appearing to alter the crime scene to cover up what he had done. Still more watched Baltimore officers drag Freddie Gray into the back of a police van for a ride he did not survive. These tragic deaths dominated perceptions of the police. They swamped and overshadowed millions of positive, professional encounters between citizens and police officers, and extraordinary anger was building toward all uniformed law enforcement. During this volatile period, in December 2014, two NYPD officers were executed by a killer claiming to be acting in retaliation by putting wings on pigs. President Obama asked me to attend one of the NYPD funerals as his representative. As I spoke to the family of Officer Wenjun Liu in a small Brooklyn funeral home, the grief was so thick as to be suffocating. Outside, thousands of stone-faced police officers stood for miles in a cold wind. I had felt the pain and anger of black communities since Ferguson, and now I could feel the pain and anger of law enforcement. Police officers didn't feel safe or appreciated on the streets they were trying to protect, and communities didn't trust the police. Law enforcement and the black community in America have long been separate, parallel lines, closer in some communities, farther apart in others. But now those lines were arcing away from each other everywhere. Each video depicting the death of a civilian at the hands of police driving one line away, each killing of a police officer arcing the other line away. I struggled with whether there was something I could say or do that would make a difference, to help bend the lines back toward each other. The FBI was a federal investigative agency, but we were deeply involved in local policing, both as a trainer of police leaders and as a key partner to uniform law enforcement. I decided I could do two things. I could use the high profile of the director's job to say some things I believed to be true, in the hope it would foster better dialogue. And then I could use the FBI's nationwide presence to drive that dialogue. So in February 2015, I went to Georgetown University and talked about four hard truths that all of us need to know. First, I said, we in law enforcement need to acknowledge the truth that we have long been the enforcers of a status quo in America that abused black people. We need to acknowledge our history because the people we serve and protect cannot forget it. Second, we all need to acknowledge that we carry implicit biases inside us, and if we aren't careful, They can lead to assumptions and injustice. Third, something can happen to people in law enforcement who must respond to incidents resulting in the arrest of so many young men of color. It can warp perspectives and lead to cynicism. Finally, I said, we all must acknowledge that the police are not the root cause of the most challenging problems in our community's worst neighborhoods, but that the actual causes and solutions are so hard that it is easier to talk only about the police. I then ordered all 56 FBI field offices around the country to convene meetings between law enforcement and communities to talk about what is true and how to build trust needed to bend those lines back toward each other. It is hard to hate up close, and the FBI could bring people up close. The public reaction to the Georgetown speech was positive. As a white FBI director with long law enforcement experience, I could say things about law enforcement history and biases that others couldn't, and many police chiefs were privately grateful. But the lines stayed far apart, and by the middle of 2015, something ominous was happening. In late summer, more than 40 of the country's largest cities reported to the FBI that they were experiencing jumps in the number of murders starting in late 2014. What was particularly unusual about the numbers was that the rise in the murder rate wasn't uniform and didn't follow any obvious pattern. In fact, about 20 of the 60 largest cities in America were not seeing increases. Some had seen fewer murders. And the cities, some with huge increases, some without, were mixed together on the American map. Even while I was speaking at Georgetown, murders were climbing, and the victims were overwhelmingly young black men. The cities with dramatic increases had different gang problems and different illegal drug patterns. What they appeared to have in common were large and concentrated poor black neighborhoods where more young black men were being shot and killed by other young black men. I was hearing from police leaders that the increases might be connected to changes in behavior among police and civilians, connected to the narratives driven by viral videos. I didn't know for sure, and I didn't have the expertise or the data to figure it out, but I was determined to raise the issue. It would be too easy for the country to ignore more deaths of black men, too easy for the country to drive around the problem, because it was happening to those people over there. Somebody had to say something to force a conversation about what was happening. My fondest wish was to be wrong and find out that something simple explained the numbers, or that this was some random but widespread statistical anomaly. At the same time, the Obama administration and an interesting alliance of liberal Democrats and libertarian Republicans in Congress